boys and girls, and everybody who's not boys and girls, and people who used to be boys and girls, and...
And people who identify as boys and girls.
Yeah. Can you identify as a boy and a girl? I guess so now. I guess you can do anything you want.
Anything
now.
You want. It's up to you.
Yeah. I was, you know, you watch these people and they've got like 8-year-old kids. They don't let them walk across the street by themselves, but they can assign themselves their own gender.
Hey, my daughter said to me not too long ago, she was saying, there's not much difference between your generation and mine. Why do you make such a big deal of it? And I said, in my generation, we drank 40-ounce bottles of malt liquor, and we drank MD 2020. I said, your generation drinks White Claw. I rest my case.
Oh, what a wonderful world. Went to the dentist yesterday, and I was just telling these guys, I get in there, and...
If you're a little squeamish, don't listen to this part of the show.
But I had no idea that it was actually that infected. And he grabbed the tooth and went, boop, tooth popped out. No big deal, right? I'm like, great. Well, then, as a dentist, he wants to go in and tear out any of the stuff that's infected.
Mm-hmm.
So he's in there with that hemostat thing, ripping stuff out of the inside, in there with a scissors cutting stuff.
And told I'm like, you so, boys and girls. You shouldn't have listened.
I was like, holy cow. You know, I thought... Okay, boy, that was easy. The tooth just pops out. Oh, no. It's never that easy, is it?
No, it's never that easy.
But
you know, if this show goes off the rails, we're going to warn you in advance. Frank brought in a bottle of Evan Williams eggnog.
It's eggnog whiskey.
Well, I didn't want to say it.
And it's not for Christmas anymore.
No, it's the original Southern eggnog.
Yes, it's not just for Christmas anymore. It's for radio shows.
That's right.
I got to tell you, that stuff is amazing because when you're downstairs, you know, you work and you're all hot and sweaty and everything, you come up, you're so thirsty, you know you can drink a gallon of water and you're still going to be thirsty. Little hit of that and... Then I drink some water afterwards, and I'm fine.
All right. Recommended by Dr. Frank.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, you would think from the way I talk about booze, I drink all the time. But I'm pretty selective. I don't drink a lot. But when I do, I want to enjoy it.
That's right. That's right. There's no reason to drink White Claw.
What is it?
It's White Claw. It's some kind of seltzer. It used to be Zima, and I think they just changed the name on it.
Yeah, that's nasty stuff.
It is.
But that's what the kids drink now?
Yeah, that's what they're drinking now, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it's an alcohol seltzer water.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah.
I think they wave the alcohol over the top of the vat. They don't actually put it in, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, but they can drink one of them and be loopy, you know.
It's all psychological.
But then they were loopy before they drank it, too.
Well, there you have it.
Let's see. All the stuff going on with the hurricane going by. I'm sitting there. Now, one of the things that's made me nuts, and I've said it quite a few times before on the show, but when they talk about hurricanes and storm surge, these bleeding idiots at the Weather Channel and all these things on TV came up with this phrase to scare the heck out of everybody. And, I mean, it's simply a terror tactic, a control tactic. 4 feet above normally dry ground. And I'm listening to these people say this. And I'm listening to these idiots talking on TV. This is, we've got a 3 to 5 foot dangerous, could be deadly storm surge coming. Is it 3 to 5 feet? No, wait a minute. I don't know of a single structure in Florida that's not 9 foot.
Right.
Got to be at least 9 foot. It's been that since the 50s.
Right.
9 foot over high tide. Now, everything on the water, when you see a chart on the water, it's done to MLLW, mean lower low water. But all of your buildings and structures are done feet above high tide. So if you're living in the sound of my voice here in Southwest Florida, and your house elevation is, say, 9 foot, and they tell you there's going to be a 4 foot storm surge 4 feet above normally dry ground. Well, that is government control speak or whatever it is for 4 feet above normal high tide.
Right.
So if your house is at 9, what the heck are you worried about?
Nothing.
I mean, it's still got 4 feet to go before it even gets to your house.
Well, no, when you think about it, what people envision with a 4 or 5 foot storm surge is that this wall of water is going to come in like a tidal wave from the Gulf that's 4 feet high.
Oh, that's good
and,
stuff.
Yeah, and it's going to follow the land all the way up to your house and sweep your car and your children and your livestock.
Yeah,
away.
It's coming into your bedroom. You know, be prepared. The buggering
now,
starts.
No, this would be a completely different conversation if you were living in Miami right now.
Well, the problem with Miami is it's sinking.
Well, and the problem with Miami is it's sea level. I mean, it's there. They have problems when the tide comes in. The water's percolating up to the limestone and coming up through the streets.
But I'd be willing to bet if someone checked the elevation of those buildings 60 years ago, I will bet they're lower than they were 60 years ago. Venice, Italy floods out all the time. Not because the sea levels come up, because I looked it up this morning just to be sure. In the last 100 years, five to eight inches.
Wow, that's quite a bit.
Look at Houston.
Yeah, but Houston sunk 8 feet when they pumped all the groundwater out.
Right.
And people don't realize that the reason Houston floods is because everybody had wells. And you drink, you go to the bathroom, you make coffee, you know, you use water. Well, when you put a well in, it takes the water out of the ground, and then the dirt settles down. And you might not see it. It's not like it cracks like a sinkhole. It just literally eases down as the water goes away. And Houston's 8 feet lower than it used to be. And I'll bet you Miami's lower, because Venice, Italy is like, God, I forget how far they sank in the last couple hundred years, but it's in the feet.
Mm.
That's why they flood all the time. The water didn't come up to them. They went down to the water. They built it on really kind of marshy land, and it's slowly going down. But they don't tell you that on normal news. But we will tell you that as part of this show, that according to the government websites, 5 to 8 inches in 100 years. Now, if we're going to go back 10,000 years, the sea level came up 400. Now, this I'm not exactly positive of, but I think it's 460 or 480 feet it's risen. During the Ice Age, it was almost 500 feet lower than it is now. 400, let's just say 450 for round numbers. But during the Ice Age, when all the glaciers were on land and everything, the actual oceans went down over 400 feet. So all of the early civilizations were dealing with, and what could have popped us out of the Ice Age could have been as simple as all that glaciers on the top of the Earth tilted it a little different. Because the earthquake in Japan tilted the Earth a little bit. An earthquake, I forget how many different earthquakes have adjusted the tilt of our planet. So it's not unreasonable to assume that if 400 feet of ocean water was stuck on glaciers at the top of the planet, it could tilt a little bit, made it warmer.
Well, you got to deal with this concept. There is a finite amount of water on Earth. We don't lose any to space, unlike Mars that lost their troposphere and then all the water left when that happened. Our water doesn't leave, so if it's liquid, it's going to go to the lowest place it can find, which is the oceans. And if it's ice, it's going to accumulate on higher ground, and the water's not going to be in the ocean. So, yeah, it goes down. It could go down a couple hundred feet and come back up again a couple hundred feet over its course of centuries.
That has to be where the canyons in Utah, the Grand Canyon, the melting glaciers had to have caused that. There's no other explanation for those huge fissures. The Mississippi River, you know, many of this stuff was all formed by melting glaciers.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But
yeah, I can see that.
So, if you want to talk sea level rise, let's just add a few years to it. So, the sea level came up 450 feet.
Okay.
So basically, all I'm saying is nothing new here.
I was looking at some charts just this morning about the archaeology of Florida, and they showed what it looked like 200 million years ago, which is basically was a little bump where the middle of the state was. That was the only thing that was above water.
Right.
And then it showed it where it was this huge mass of land and now to where it is today where it's a peninsula.
Yeah, it actually attached to Texas at one point.
That's right. And that explains why we find all these whale bones and porpoise bones and things like that in the springs in Central Florida, because that was underwater.
And it could very well go back to that. But this is nothing new.
No, it happens. It's a cycle. We may accelerate it or slow it down a little bit, but not by much.
Yeah, it's just, with the hurricanes going by, my big concern is hurricanes go in a counterclockwise motion. So as the hurricane comes from the south going north on the west coast of Florida, the leading edge is nothing. Because it's pulling the water out. It's blowing the water away from shore. So the tide drops really, really low. And the one thing you can do when you see how far out the water goes, that's approximately what the water's, how much more water you're going to get when it goes the other way.
Right.
Now, add about 18 inches for outgoing versus incoming. Because it's harder to stack the water out to the Gulf. So you're going to get about another 18 inches. If it drops 2 feet before the storm, it's going to come up 3.5 or so after the storm. Now, if you're on the east coast of Florida listening, you know, the leading edge of the storm is when you get all the water. So you have no preparation time. You know, during the first part of a hurricane here, I go out, I look, and go, okay, it's down 2 feet. I know I should get 3.5 feet of water above where the water is supposed to be because it's 2 feet below where the water is supposed to be.
Right.
Just little things like that. But it's just so funny. If I'm going to make adequate preparations, you need a gallon of water per person, and then you got to figure on 2 meals a day for everybody there. And if you've got a family of three and you got to have it for 7 days, that's 3 gallons of water times seven. That's 21 gallons of water for 7 days for three people. And the dumbest thing people do is if you don't drink a lot of water, I drink Diet Coke or Diet Pepsi or whatever. I drink diet sodas. That's what I like to drink. I make sure I have enough of those to get me through. It doesn't have to be water. Now, because I'm diabetic, I drink a lot of extra water, but it's in the form of coffee. So I make sure I've got several diet sodas for each day, a gallon of water so I can make coffee. She's going to drink tea, you know. But then with food, start thinking about it. 2 meals times 7 days, right? That's 14, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you do go times three, because a lot of people like to eat three times a day, I eat once or twice. And I know I'm diabetic. I'm supposed to eat every 4 hours. I'm going to die. But
sooner or later.
Yeah. Well, you know, eat right, exercise, live healthy. You're going to die. Be, you know, smoke, have a couple extra drinks. You're going to die. I live in Florida, so I know it's way worse to live 5 years too long than it is to die 5 years too early. But let's get to the fishing. That's enough of this crazy stuff. Sorry about that. But, you know, it's relevant, hurricanes and all this stuff. They scare everybody.
They do scare everybody. And we've had such a massive inflow this year of new people that are not familiar with this stuff. So those scare tactics work. But the sad part is that it works in the opposite manner on the next storm when it's actually important. You know, because they're out there watching the news this morning. It's like, they drove all over Cape Coral just to find one area where there was a couple palm fronds laying in somebody's yard and one bush tipped over just to say how great the aftermath was, you know, and it's
how will we survive this horrible aftermath of the storm?
Right.
It could have been a catastrophic storm. It could have picked up speed. It could have regenerated itself. It could have been a Cat 3 or Cat 4.
Mm-hmm.
General rule of thumb, tropical storm category 1, get the cocktails ready. pick up the yard, make sure nothing's going to fly into the neighbor's house. It's party time. Category two, got to pay attention. Because with a category two, you don't know what's going to happen. Because that could be iffy. Now, with a category three, no cocktails, no nothing. Head down, hunker down, make sure everything is put up, and you're in a really safe spot. Category four, lift your skirt, scream like a little girl who just lost her Barbie, and go to Vegas.
Yeah.
There's nothing, no other, do not stay for a category four. No. Everybody, when you're new to Florida, you want to see you rode out a hurricane. Oh, I was there for the hurricane. The heck with that. You know what post-traumatic stress is? That's what will get you. Category four will get you hurt, get you killed, leave.
And make you extremely gun-shy for the rest of your life.
Oh, absolutely. You will never be right after category four.
Well, flat out speak from experience on that one, and you can too.
The thing is, on a one or two, it's cool. It's a really bad thunderstorm. And it'll scare you a little bit, but it won't leave any traumatizing marks. You know how you tell a really bad hurricane? If it messed you up.
Yeah.
Now, if it got the guy down the street with a tornado or whatever, because a lot of tornadoes and hurricanes, for him, that was the worst hurricane ever. But for you, it wasn't bad.
Right.
It all depends. Does it wreck your house or not?
Right.
Then if it wrecks your house, that was the worst hurricane ever. But if it didn't, it wasn't so bad.
Yeah. No, I agree.
It's all relative. Yeah.
Yeah. I just, you know, my concern is, like you said, tropical storm / a one, you should be at least prepared with some stuff because it can build quickly in some instances, but you don't need to worry about it until 2 days before it's to get here. Like the one, you know, my mother was calling me every day. I'm like, Mom, wait until it crosses Cuba. Means nothing until it crosses Cuba. Then I'll pay attention to it. Until it gets there, quit watching all this negative news garbage. Ignore all of it. And
well, because it's every storm is the most dangerous, stupid thing out there. And it's just garbage. Here's the way, you know, if you're listening to this and if you haven't got bored and turned the channel, which I wouldn't have blamed you. But when I was in my 20s and Terry was in her 20s, she had a Hobie Cat sailboat. I used to do a lot of windsurfing, you know, the surfboard with the sail on it. I was big into that. We could not wait for the tropical storms to get here.
Right.
That mean we had wind and waves to work with. We were out, you know, sailboarding and, you know, doing the Hobie Cat stuff. That was, you look forward to the tropical storms because that's where the fun was.
That's what all the surfers have been doing for the last 4 days up at Venice Inlet.
Yeah.
I mean, there's 3-footers crashing on the jetties this morning. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of surfers there. They are just waiting for those things because you just don't get many opportunities like that.
I mean, we couldn't wait. I was out, and we were going from Port Charlotte Beach out to Marker 2 and back. I know a couple times I hit well over 60 miles an hour on that windsurfer. Got flipped over the end, crashed and burned, but had a lot of fun. If I was a little younger and not quite so beat up, I'd still be out doing it. So you can look at tropical storms as the danger and, oh, my God. Or you can look at it in a nice way to balance everything out. Everything got a lot cooler. The water temperatures dropped. The air temperatures went down. Everything got a little better after the storm. A good tropical storm is a good cleaning agent. Like those.
Right, and a lot of the surface pollutants, red tide and the stuff that came out of Piney Point and everything else, as the hurricane goes up the coast, it's pulling that stuff out into deeper water. It's pushing some on shore, but as you said, as the front edge of the storm gets up, it's pulling everything out and away. So the water's cleaned up quite a bit.
Diluted down.
And the other thing is freshwater fishing. Now is the time for the spillways and the culverts and things like that, because that water is moving like you wouldn't believe.
Right.
Yeah, it's been the fishing right now is actually pretty good. We're going to get to that. I'm sorry I was supposed to.
But it's still a fishing show?
Yeah,
I thought this was the Weather Channel.
Oh, God, no. Yeah, I have never belonged to a political party in my life, but if I was ever going to join one, it couldn't be that. I would never scare people. I can be mean and rude and all these other things, but I would never, ever go out of my way to terrify people the way they do. I don't get it. That's why I wanted to say this. We had fun during tropical storms. Yeah. They are not a horrible, evil thing. It's a great leveler. I mean, it helps clean stuff up, provides a lot of rain. You know, these are actually beneficial things, unless it destroys your house. And then it's a really horrible thing.
Right, and the odds of a tropical storm destroying your house are slim to none.
Very slim, but you could always get that off-chance tornado.
Right, that's true. You always get a tornado passing.
You never know.
But,
so
but the
we always got
to
be
the
careful.
Point being the odds. You know, you get in your car and you drive to the supermarket. The odds are they're not zero, but you could get hit by another car.
Right. Anything you do in life has risk. Mm-hmm. Like I say, if you run and exercise and eat healthy every day, you're going to die anyway. There's no way around this.
Yeah, well,
stuff.
I'm going to open a White Claw.
Okay. You God, no. All right. Is there a chance we can go offshore fishing, Robert?
Not today, but I would say by definitely Saturday. Should be calm enough by then because there's still 3 foot to 4 footers crashing up there in Venice from what I was told by somebody this morning.
It's going to take a little while.
If you look at the buoys, one of the fun things to do when a storm comes through is go look at the buoy data from NOAA. And you can see the wave heights and the wave frequency and stuff. And as of this morning, there's still six-foot waves out there.
Oh, yeah.
And 10 and 12-foot swells out there. So you're probably not going to want to go offshore today.
No. But over the next couple of days, it's going to start to slowly calm down. Plus, we got that as that hurricane goes past, tropical storm, whatever, it sucks in a lot of wind from behind it, below it, and to the sides of it. So it actually drew in some of that drier air mass from the west side of the Gulf. Exactly. So that drier air is going to help with reducing thunderstorms and calming the winds down in general. So I think offshore this weekend would be a pretty good chance. And since nobody's been able to fish it for at least the last 4 or 5 days reasonably, you've got...
Now, we had a guy come in, and this is not an isolated incident. I mean, for one, the size it was. A wahoo in 90 feet of water. This thing is genuinely 6 foot long.
Yeah, it's a huge wahoo.
Huge wahoo. Right out here, pretty much... You figure straight off of Englewood is about where we're seeing it. And he's not the only one that's been hitting them.
No, another gentleman got us off of Venice.
I saw pictures on Facebook. I said, what is that? Is that a king? No, that's the wrong color for a king. It's got a different kind of mouth than a king. Oh, it's a wahoo.
Yeah.
It's a rare event that we get them here, but it's worth going to look for.
And it's a well-named fish. If you've ever hooked into one, you're going to say, wahoo.
Yeah, well, that's exactly where I think they got the name from, right?
It's like catching a guided missile.
Yeah.
Not a torpedo, it's a missile.
Yeah, and this time of year, you know, it's just this is truly the time of year. July and August are the two main months where you'll pick them up out there in the Gulf. So it's worth trolling some of your deeper depth-specific lures if you want them. But usually it's that 90 feet of water is kind of the beginning of where you start to look for them at. But we've had guys over the years hit them in as shallow as 65 feet of water, you know, which is not very deep at all. But that's the biggest wahoo I've ever seen caught over
on
here.
On this coast.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm used
it's
to seeing like
ones. I mean, he kicked my butt. My biggest wahoo is in the 40 inches.
Yeah, I'm used to seeing them like in the 3 foot range or so being caught here.
Yeah.
But that one was a stud fish. That was a true 60 to 80 pound fish.
Yeah, big.
Now, wahoo feed in mid-depth, right, in the water column. You're not going to get them on a surface lure, pretty much. You're going to get them on a fairly deep trolled lure.
What I'm going to do, I'm going to stack my lures up because I'm going to go with a lure that goes down like 40 feet.
Yes.
Then I'm going to do one at 15 or 20 feet. Further back, I'm going to start with that big one. It's real close to the boat, back right side, a 40, 30 foot, hopefully a 40. And then on the back left side of the boat, I'm going to put out one that's 15 to 20 foot, but I want it further back by about 10 feet. And then on the mid gunnel, I'm going to come off back on the same side as my deepest one. I'm going to go with one that's about a 6 foot troller. And then on the opposite side again, over that second lure, I'm going to put one further out that might be a skirted lure, could be a dolphin getter, just something that's not really going to come out of the water, but could, a popper, any type of skirted trolling bait there. But the other ones are going to be depth specifics like the Rapala or, you know, there's a lot of companies now. Nomad's really making a mark for itself on these trolling baits.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really surprised. I didn't think anybody was going to touch Rapala for as far as, you know.
Quality.
Accuracy. Straight, depth specific, you know. And Nomad's putting a big push on their trolling stuff.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's good, too. That's the thing that's scary is the man stuff. You catch fish on it, but you don't know what direction it's going to swim, left, right, or middle.
Right.
They're very inconsistent trollers, and unless you've got a huge pair of channel locks with you, it's too hard to adjust. What I end up doing with the man stuff is, okay, it's pulling to the left, I got to put it on that side of the boat. Otherwise, it goes into the other lures.
Right.
You know, if it's pulling to the right, I want it on the right side of the boat. If it's pulling to the left, I got to put it on the left. Very seldom is a man's lure tracked straight. Usually one side or the other.
Yeah,
but
that's true.
The Nomad's really kicking butt, and they're catching a lot of fish with them.
Right, and when you get out to that depth of water in that, like, 90 feet of water, as long as you're not going right over a reef, a Wahoo will crush it in a heartbeat, and so will a King Mackerel. But if you actually want to just truly target the Wahoo, you really need to get into, like, some of the speed plugs. That way you can eliminate or reduce your Barracuda bycatch or your King Mackerel bycatch because you can actually – most guys –
6-7 miles an hour,
actually
10
close,
miles an hour.
10 to 14 is what they usually hit Wahoo at. That's kind of the speed trolling that they look for. But they'll still in a heartbeat crush something going at 4 to 6 miles an hour, you know, and at that depth, it's
awesome. Stacking my lures up.
Right.
I'm using that deep one down close to the boat, the next one up a little bit, a little further back, next one up a little bit further back, and the next one probably right close to the surface or on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like they kind of get their attention drawn by those deeper, bigger plugs. But then I've got smaller stuff as I go up, and it seems to draw their eye up with the stacked lures.
Right.
And I get most of mine on the smaller stuff up by the top rather than the big ones on the bottom, but I get a lot more hits by using those big ones as chum.
Right.
They're sound chumming. They're just digging so deep and pulling so hard that it gets the fish's attention. Now, whether they're going to eat it or not, it's a different story. But the one that third and fourth ones, you know, the furthest back and the next one, that's where I get most of my fish. But without the other ones, I don't get as much.
Yeah, but also by stacking your lures, you get a much more, you got a lot more variety because it's not just at that point, you're not just looking for one species. You've got Wahoo, dolphin, blackfin tuna, bonita, King mackerel, sailfish.
And the lures are getting a lot smaller. As I'm going towards the surface, the lures are smaller, you know.
Right.
I'm not doing big lures.
They're also further back. I mean, I've seen Wahoo down at about 110 feet. Which was about my limit back in the early days. And they do run along as close to the bottom as they can, and then they come up to attack the bait fish that are further up in the water column. So when that big lure goes by it, it's down at 40 feet. You've got their attention. Now they come up. But if you're running 6, 9, 10 miles an hour, you're going to run around the speed that they run at. And so then they're looking up, and they see the next lures coming through. And that's why usually the middle lures are the ones that do the best.
Yeah.
But if you just run in the middle lure, you're going to get the same effect, that they're going to hear it, they're going to see it, they're going to move up, and it's already out of their range to attack it.
Yeah, it's that first lure, that big, deep, thumping, you know, that I get more hits when I'm using that.
Yeah.
You know,
That lure won't get a hit, because if you happen to run it through a school of Wahoo, they're going to nail it. But generally speaking, you're attracting them to it.
When I do get a hit on it, it's one heck of a fish.
It's one big one.
I mean, it's a big monster fish, but it happens very rarely. But that's the same thing. If I'm using all big lures going all the way to the top, I'm not catching near as many fish. The activity lures are the ones that are 2.5, 3.5 inches, 2 to 3 inches long.
Mm-hmm.
And small stuff, because anything will eat a snack.
Right.
But you got to be hungry to eat a meal. So, but, so we're going out 90 feet of water for the Wahoo. Anything else out there that once the weather comes down?
Yeah, they're getting a red grouper and even a few gag grouper in like that 75 to 90 feet of water. Heard of a couple amberjacks. Once you get out to 130 to 140 feet of water, that's where they're catching the bigger red snapper and a few African pompano. And they've been seeing more consistent numbers of the small little schoolie dolphin and an oddball sailfish. So much better chance. But the weird part is, you know what I've been hearing a lot about too in that 70 to 90 feet of water? There's been a lot of the little football-sized blackfin tuna out there, and it's not just bonita. They're actually like the little 4 to 6 pound blackfins that
really? They
always talk about in the key, or that they always catch in the Keys.
Yeah, I mean, I've caught them down the Keys.
There's a lot of people talking about them the last 2 weeks of the different schools of them out there that they're catching.
Now, let's say you see them going by the boat. You going to stop and cast, or are you going to keep trolling?
I'm going to cast. That's going to be my preference.
Pull the throttles back, hit neutral, and start casting.
Yeah. Yeah, I like throwing those little Williamson, they're like the jigging spoons that they make.
Oh, the little lead spoons.
Yeah, the little lead spoons, but it's going to be like the 3-inch or the 2-inch. And what I like to do is run and gun where you get up in front of the school that's blitzing and cast past them and let it sink down a little ways to count to 5 or 10. And then start retrieving it, because you'll have a lot of times there's bonita, but the blackfin are mixed in with them, but they're always hanging behind and below. So I want that bait to go past the bonita, sink down, and as I'm retrieving it, those bonita have already kind of started to pass through, and as I'm starting to retrieve it, it's hopefully getting in line with one of the blackfins.
What I like is the pompano jigs for that,
because
they're very heavy but very tiny.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I can sling them forever, get a really good long cast. Now, a lot of people think, okay, if I get an 8-foot rod, I want a big reel on it, you know, and I've got big line and all that, and I'm exactly the opposite. If I'm using an 8-foot rod, which I quite often carry out into the Gulf because I'm looking for distance,
right,
is I've got a much smaller reel on it with as light of line as I feel I can get away with. Which would braid would probably be 6 or 8 pound, at the most 10. I'm using a 2,500 to 3,000 size reel. Now, the reason I'm using that little reel is now I can get away with braid. When we had mono, I was throwing 6 pound test mono out there.
Right.
8 pound, maybe 10. But what it was with the smaller reel, as the line comes off the spool, it's in a much smaller loop.
Right.
You got a 4,000, and picture the line coming off as you cast. That's going to be about 6 inches around or 8 inches around, that loop that has to go through the guides. And every bit of line that touches the guides is friction, slows down the cast. So if I can put little tiny skinny line on there and a smaller diameter spool, I'm going to make that casting as it's coming off that reel, the loop's a lot smaller. And as it goes through the guides quicker, I can get a farther cast out of it. The longer the rod, the more leverage I have to get that cast. So very long rods, very small reels, very light line, and I want to be able to zing it. I mean, I'm looking for that quarter-mile cast.
Right. Well, and you're fishing open water. As long as you've got the motor running and paying attention, you can chase down the fish and hopefully keep all your line on, unlike I do.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the whole thing. It's open water. So why not use the light line so it takes me a little longer to land the fish? That's why I'm there.
Right.
I'm looking for the fight. I want to have the drag going and coming back and doing all that.
Absolutely.
That's the whole fun of it.
Another thing that's kind of sometimes a giveaway with blackfin tuna out there, if you're confused and not sure if it's bonita or blackfin tuna, and this isn't the case all the time, but it is something to look for, is that when they're blitzing on the surface, you'll actually see them like frothing up the surface as they're feeding on all that little fry out there and going nuts. Blackfin tuna, when they're mixed in with the bonita, I'd say at least 50% of the time, clear the water. Like completely.
Blackfin tuna jump.
Yeah, they'll actually clear the water versus your bonita will just break the surface. Every now and then, bonita will clear the surface, but very seldom.
Often.
Very seldom. But if you see something launching into the air, and it's usually not straight up in the air the way you would like see a king mackerel or something, but they're like launching, like paralleling the water and going right back in, almost like you would picture a dolphin doing as it's riding the wake,
yeah,
or something. Yeah, that's usually a sign that those are blackfin tuna mixed in with them, or it's strictly just a school of the little blackfin tuna altogether.
God, I wish I had my boat. We're talking about this. I'm going to go out there.
Right.
Not today.
Not today,
but soon.
Right.
But I'm looking forward to it. I really am, yeah, being able to go out there and, you know, enjoy the time on the water.
It'll be good for you.
Yeah, because you're running the store.
Yeah. Can I have another shot?
Yeah. Hey, Robert, have another White Claw.
Seltzer water with alcohol? Really?
Yep.
Yeah.
But if it's in a can, it's got wine or beer-based alcohol. It's not going to have actual...
It is what it is.
I mean, this is genuinely whiskey. It's not wine whiskey.
Right.
Yeah. I guess I'm a snob. I didn't realize that.
Join the club.
I'm kind of a snob. I'm going to drink whiskey, by God, I want, you know, give me something oak barrel. I want whiskey. I don't want something wine with chemicals in it to make it taste like whiskey. All right, here's a weird one for you. Now, RJ, Robert and I were talking about on the truck coming up here. Robert's fishing in the canal, actually, probably Christina was. Catches a 20-inch snook and reels in half of it. Literally cut right in half. See, can you see the picture?
Mm-hmm.
What did that?
Bull shark?
My first guess. Robert's first guess.
Barracuda next.
No, there's no barracuda that far up in the canals.
That's what I would think.
Sennets don't get big enough. They're the only barracuda-ish thing, but they wouldn't get big enough to chop a 20-inch snook in half. They'd tear it up, but they wouldn't be able to, you know, go through the backbone on it. Sennet's the barracuda that you see in the backwaters in the backcountry.
Yes.
Very seldom get larger than 2 feet.
Yeah. You'll see teeth marks in the fish and them tearing them up, but it actually go through the backbone on a 20-inch snook. Sennet just ain't got jaw power for
it. The other possibility is going to be a gator, right?
Gator could. Now, gator I would could. Have said this was possible gator, except the bite's slightly rounded. It's not quite cut off flat.
Right, and it's not shredded easy either.
When you look close at it, it's a fairly clean bite. Now, I would say flipper could do that.
Right.
Dolphins.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a possibility, but...
It doesn't look...
But also, flipper would come up to the top pretty quick.
Right.
With a mouthful of fish, he's going to come up to blow and...
Yeah. And probably throw the fish at you.
Yeah. Probably.
Yeah. So. This left a decent little footprint next to the boat when it bit it. So it wasn't like a giant footprint like
boil.
Flipper might do. Yeah. Yeah, a boil in the water.
All right, so I'm completely flummoxed. I have no idea. Then it looks like there's some strange, ragged
bite mark. I would say bull shark's probably the only thing I could think of that would have the bite power there to do that in a canal.
Well, we've seen bull shark do that with bait, you know, where they'll take a big piece of bait and they'll chomp right through it in an instant, not even a tug, just it's done. So
yeah. I can't think of another species, like you say, flipper, dolphins, but you would know they were there.
Right. Mm-hmm. And again, with the bull shark, from when I've seen sharks hit things, they go down. They'll hit it and they'll go down to the bottom with whatever their prize is. They don't come up to the top and toss it around like you see a white shark do. So I guess if you didn't see anything, I'd lean more towards bull shark again.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I'm going with, because I've had several people catch little bull sharks in the canals. I mean, it's not an unusual thing. It's just not a common, like, targetable thing.
Right.
Well, this time of year is when the bull sharks are up by 75, 41, mm-hmm. over by the, up in the canals and stuff.
Right.
It just, another one of those things, you know, they're telling us deadly storm surge. It's 3, 4, maybe 5 foot. Oh, my God. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, how full of garbage there. But all these canals, you never think about it. But they got a lot of bull sharks in them.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's why the adults come in here to pup, so they have plenty of safe places to go hide from larger sharks.
Yeah, because the biggest predator to little sharks is big sharks.
Right.
But it just surprises me. We don't think of shark fishing in the canals, but it's a very real possibility.
Yeah.
Here's something for you. When the hurricanes are going up through the Gulf, right? They're going up, and I mean, they're just sucking up tons of water, right? That hot water. And they're dumping billions of gallons of rain onto, you know, land. How come it's not salty? How come there's no salt in the rain? They say it's evaporation that the hurricane's taking up, where a tornado could actually deposit salt water on land. But you would think with as massive of a thing as a hurricane is, just drawing moisture out of the air, technically, you know, evaporation, drawing moisture out of the air,
sure,
and dump billions of gallons on land. Because there's no salt in it.
Well, I think most of the water you're seeing coming out of the hurricane is coming from the clouds above the hurricane. It's creating a rain event up there.
Exactly, but evaporation.
Right. So, but a tornado, certainly, I think it was like back in the 1980s, a tornado, a fairly big water spout came through by Ruskin, and it dropped a ton of water on the tomato farms up there. And it basically wiped out the tomato farms because it was all salt water. It was dumping water from the bay onto the tomatoes.
And that's the difference between a waterspout slash tornado and a hurricane. A waterspout tornado thing is actually sucking water up out of the Gulf. So you see that funnel? That's actually water. It's pulling from, you know, the Gulf or a lake or whatever it's in. It's sucking that water up to the cloud level, so it actually has salt in it.
Right.
The thing that amazes me about a hurricane, it relies on evaporation. There's a tiny bit, maybe, salt because of the spray from the waves or something mm-hmm. like that. But overall, it's just straight out evaporation.
It's mostly air. Mostly air being pulled up, warm air going up and up to be cooled off in the upper ends. And when the warm air gets to the top of the hurricane, it drives that condensation that creates the rain.
But so, think about the amount of condensation that has to be going on to create that much water. Walk out in your yard with a garden hose and start spraying it around, and you're going to be out there for, you know, average-sized front yard, what, an hour to put a quarter inch of water on there?
Mm-hmm.
And this hurricane is dumping over 100 miles, 50 miles wide, 100 miles long. It's putting a quarter inch of water on there in a matter of minutes. Imagine the amount of evaporation that has to go on for that. Boggles my head.
It is. That's a crazy amount.
Because it's not pulling water out of the Gulf. It's got evaporated out of the Gulf. It's small distinction. I get easily amused. Spillways. The bass fishing's doing pretty good.
Bass fishing.
Is anybody doing any snook or tarpon at the bottom of the spillways?
Yeah, a guy fished Shell Creek this morning and got a bunch of little snook and saw a couple tarpon. He didn't catch any big snook, didn't even hear any big snook. Lots of little snook popping away. And then he also had stopped at the one over there on Taylor Road, right there at Alligator Creek. And same thing, a lot of little snook, and a couple guys had climbed around the fence and were bass fishing on the opposite side. He didn't see any big bass, but he saw a couple 2-pounders that the guys were catching. But he said the amount of bluegill that he was seeing, little bluegill getting pushed over and then just swimming around on that freshwater side trying to fight the current from getting pushed over there at that Taylor Creek Dam. And then I've had several people tell me about, just even with the rains that we had last week, the bluegill have been starting to really turn on at some of the culvert pipes and little spill dams over there on 9 Mile Canal. And some up over here, and they've been fishing some of the ponds off of Sumpner, mm-hmm. fishing some of those ponds and getting some nice bluegill around some of those culvert pipes that are moving.
And I'm very happy to see the bluegill population exploding over the last couple of years. And I credit the Mayan cichlids with that.
Yeah, giving them food.
Yeah, the huapotes, the machacas, all these South American, Central American fish, the invasive species that are here.
Mm-hmm.
They are reinvigorating the bluegill population beyond belief.
Oh, yeah.
because bluegills over the last few years started hitting minnows, where before you kind of got to have worms for them.
Yeah.
But now they're eating minnows. So that means their primary food has changed a bit. And the one thing that's really changed is thousands of these little fry from these non-native species.
Well, because they breed throughout the entire year. They're not like our native species where it's just the late winter, early spring hatch and that's it. The cichlids all breed multiple times throughout the year, so it's providing a huge amount of food for them all year long.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really shocked, but it's the only thing that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I could be all wet. It's amazing how many people are going to come down here to Florida and fix everything that's wrong with us. They're from the north, right? And this guy's telling me, well, there's not enough big bull reds in the harbor anymore. And I said, well, they're not supposed to be here.
Wrong time of year.
No, he thought they were supposed to be here all year, but he's going to fix what's wrong with us. Well, super nice guy.
Well, one of the things
very
you should
smart,
learn.
But believe it or not, you should learn something about the area before you try to tell me you're going to fix it.
Right.
Well, and one of the things about this show that I'm kind of proud of is we're always learning something new, teaching something new. Like, I didn't know that the reds left, the big guys left.
Yeah, they go migrate.
But now I know. And so I know you're not going to, just like the shrimp. We were talking about tiny shrimp at this time of year. And I still suggest you guys should be super gluing them together in the tank so you can sell them as big shrimp. But get a couple of kids in to super glue the shrimp together.
Little tiny pieces of duct tape to strap them all up. Uh-huh. Yeah,
that'll work.
Yeah.
But it's all part of the natural process. It doesn't mean that all the big shrimp died off and there's only little ones left. It means the big ones went to go do what they do.
Yeah, they moved off.
Mm-hmm. And the little ones will eventually get big again, and then they'll move off.
Right.
It's not the end of the world.
Right. We have 5 minutes here.
And every,
I thought we had two.
Yeah, call it five.
Okay,
every state sees that, too. No matter where you're at, you know, there's always a few here and a few there, but there's better numbers. Whether you're from the northeast, striped bass are only there for a couple few months heavy out of the year of the big ones, and then it's little ones the rest of the year. Or your fluke, same thing.
Black drum.
Yes.
Big, small, here, not here.
All big.
All big.
Big.
Yeah, there's a lot of pictures on Facebook of big.
Yeah, 30-pounders, 40-pounders, the 75 bridge, a few at the 41 bridge.
Are the spawning balls here now? Big, huge? I had one guy talked about it.
Yeah, I didn't hear much about it at all.
Most magnificent thing he ever saw.
Yeah, yeah, it's
pretty
impressive.
Well, you got to figure, boys and girls, what we're talking about is a school of 100, 500, 1,000-plus fish, all of them 30 to 60 pounds, acting like a big ball of minnows going across the harbor.
Yeah.
And they'll be in 15 feet of water. They're from the bottom to the surface boiling.
Yeah.
And it's this huge thing of, I've only seen it a couple times, but this is amazing.
Yeah. I've only got to see it once, but it was absolutely just stunning. And black drum don't really get credit. I mean, they actually have those long pectoral fins on their side, and when they're just kind of moseying along, it's almost angelic watching their fins rotate around as they're just kind of controlling them, their big body mass with those weird long fins. It's pretty cool.
For such a big, bulky, dopey-looking fish, they're actually quite graceful.
They are. Yeah, it's really, really neat to see.
And black drum have whiskers. Mm-hmm. On the bottom of their chin. Barbels, I guess they're called?
Yep.
Now, they go right along the bottom with them or through the mid-depths. But when they're going along the bottom with them, they're tasting the bottom with those chin whiskers. Correct?
Yeah.
So you put a crab out on the bottom or a shrimp for black drum, I bottom fish for them. Because if they get a hint of it through that whiskers and stuff, they can go down to the bottom and figure out where that at, and they're actually very accurate on following smells.
Yes, they are. They're unbelievably good at following those smells.
Now, what I like about the black drum is they've got the mouth, they got the very rough lips. There's no teeth in there, but they got a mouth with lips like wood rasp. But right inside of the mouth, just towards the back of their throat, they got these massive crusher plates.
Yeah.
It reminds me, you know, gold stampers. Boom, boom, boom. I mean, they can get a blue crab. If they get it in the back of their throat, it is one flat blue crab. It's crushed.
Yeah. It's like running over the steamroller.
It's amazing that here's this fish with basically a hammer inside its mouth.
Yeah.
Hammer and an anvil.
Yeah. Yeah, and it just crushes that crab and utilizes all of the meat out of that thing. But they're fun to catch.
But we talked a little bit about the bull sharks, but there's bull sharks all around the harbor yet. Mm-hmm. Anything big out there right now?
I haven't heard of too much big. I mean, a couple in the 5 foot to 6 foot range as far as bull sharks go, and a couple 4 to 5 foot black tips. Other than that, the majority of them are the black nose and the sharp nose in that 2.5 to 3 foot range.
Right.
Well, a 5 foot bull shark will beat the crap out of you. That's
a
fun fish.
They're
to
definitely
catch.
Fun. There's no question about it.
You know, they have that new snook record out there, 51.4 pounds.
Yeah.
But I've caught 52 inch snook, but I caught it August, September, completely empty belly in middle high 30 pound range. If I would have caught it in May or June, it probably would have been a world record fish.
Yeah.
It's just funny what time of year you catch them as to what it is. But this is a Pacific snook.
It is.
It's pretty much a different species.
It is, but the previous world record has been there for over 20 years, and it was only
47.8.
Yeah, so for him to break a new record, that's pretty impressive. And it was a surf fisherman fishing from shore, and he actually thought it was rooster fish that he was casting his mullet to.
Well, when he landed it quickly, he said it got real close to shore fairly quickly. He said, well, this ain't a rooster fish. It's not fighting hard enough.
Yeah.
There's a difference between a jack and a snook.
Yeah, exactly.
A rooster fish is like a jack crevel.
Yeah.
You're going to get 2, 3, 4 times the fight out of it, pound per pound.
Yeah. Yeah, just an impressive feat, though. I mean, nonetheless, you know, and you can't really beat the Florida record anymore now that there's no keeping them of any size over. So until they change those laws, it'll be what it is.
So, RJ, any last-minute instructions?
Keep your white claw cold.
Yes.
Otherwise, you can't drink it. Boy, it tastes horrible. How did I get this?
Okay. Robert.
Go out and enjoy this nice changing of the water out there. It's going to be interesting the next several days figuring it out.
Me, I got nothing. See you, boys and girls. Bye. I'm going